Good evening. I invite you to open your Bibles to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2 is where we will begin this evening. I was told that everybody that was here Sunday morning, or virtually everyone that was here on Sunday morning, would be back on Sunday night, and that is indeed true. And I'm encouraged by that. That is as it ought to be. But unfortunately, it is often not the case. And I'm really encouraged by your presence. Look forward to spending the week with you. As I mentioned this morning, we'll spend our time Monday night through Friday night studying from the book of Philippians. And so if you want to incorporate that into your Bible reading, perhaps that will give you some benefit in our studies throughout the week. In Judges chapter 2, I'd like to read with you beginning in verse 11. In Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 11. The text tells us that the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so that they were severely distressed. We are talking about the nation of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The people whom God had formed into a nation out of a mere 70 or 75 people sojourning in the land of Egypt. A nation that some 400 plus years later, upon their exodus from Egypt, numbered well in excess, by most conservative estimates, well in excess of 1 million people. A people that God brought out of the land of Egypt through a series of miraculous plagues inflicted upon their enemies in Egypt. A people that God allowed not only to escape the bondage of slavery in Egypt, but to leave not merely as freed slaves, but in possession of great wealth. A people whose way God superintended every step, parting the waters of the Red Sea so that they might pass on dry ground, making a covenant with them at the foot of Mount Sinai, being with them as they journeyed in the wilderness for a period of 40 years, so that during the course of that 40 years, their feet did not swell and their garments did not wear out. Providing water out of rocks, manna and quail from heaven, and taking care of their every need, preparing them and purifying them to be the nation that God wanted them to be, bringing them to the very precipice of that land on the eastern side of the Jordan River, parting those waters as he had 40 years prior, the waters of the Red Sea, and giving them the land that they quite frankly did not earn. This is a people into whose hand God delivered their enemies. The city of Jericho stood as the first fortified city in this promised land against which they would come against, and he did not deliver that city by Israel's military might. But instead, encircling the city with the forces of Israel and marching around that city once a day for 6 days, seven times on the seventh day, blowing horns and shouting, and the walls of the city, not because of any military strategy on the part of these people, the walls of that city collapsing so that the people were able, each man, to go straight ahead wherever they were in encompassing that city and take that city. A people who bit by bit, little by little, were given the land that had been promised to their forefathers centuries before. But now, in Judges chapter 2, they are a people who have forsaken the very one who has made them into that great nation. They have abandoned him who delivered them from Egypt. They have abandoned him who fed them from heaven. They have abandoned the one who has superintended their welfare and seen to their every success. Instead of serving the Lord who had served them, instead of serving God who had so clearly demonstrated his superiority over all of the nations, of all of the peoples whom they dispossessed from the land of Canaan, they have turned to those very false gods who themselves could not protect, deliver, or in any other way provide for the people standing against the God of heaven. And now Israel is no longer the plunderer, but the one being plundered. They are no longer the aggressor overtaking their enemies, but they are being overtaken by them. They are no longer the ones who are able to stand in the face of great military and political pressure, but they are the ones who are collapsing under their own misdeeds. The hand of the Lord, which has blessed them beyond any nation of human history to that point, that same hand is now against them for evil. And wherever they go, and whatever they do, they are severely distressed. Did that just happen overnight? Is it suddenly that at this point in Israel's history, a proverbial switch is flipped? That they unexpectedly, all of a sudden, and with no explanation whatsoever, decide to turn from being a nation which serves the living God of heaven to one who will abandon him for those which are not gods and will suffer the consequences? Rather, how did they get to this point? Where did it all begin in their history? When did things happen to go so terribly wrong? In the history of Israel, what were the roots of their apostasy? And from Israel's history, what can we learn about those same roots of apostasy in our lives today? Apostasy springs from the roots of a defective spiritual education. Look again in the book of Judges, chapter 2. We know that in Israel's early generations, the Lord had made provisions for the spiritual education of his people. I have often said that the book of Deuteronomy gives biblical precedent for what we do as preachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You see, the vast majority of those who compose our audiences on a weekly basis are not those who have never heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. They are not those who are in the world and lost in sin. In fact, many times they are those who have for many years sat in similar places, listening to similar things being taught again and again. They are well informed, highly biblically educated people, and yet we still have a responsibility, and people like Gary and myself and others are given the privilege of doing what we do. And I believe the book of Deuteronomy gives us precedent for that, because itself was a second telling of the law. That is, it is nothing more than a series of reminders. It was not the dispensing of new or novel information on the part of Moses to the people of Israel, but rather he was reminding them of their history. He was telling them again about their background and how it was that they came to be where they were, and the law by which they were to be governed in an effort to serve the Lord who had so brought them to this point. They are now, as of the book of Deuteronomy, encamped on that eastern side of the Jordan River. They are encamped on the plains of Moab. They are on the precipice of entering that promised land. And Moses, because of his sin, he and Aaron, when they struck the rock instead of speaking to it, because of that, they were not going to have the privilege of leading the people on this final campaign across the Jordan River to take the ultimate promised land. And so Moses is preparing the people to go forward without him. And to do that, he knows that they need to know who they are and from whence they have come. He knows that they need to be reminded of the covenant into which they entered as the people of God at the foot of Mount Sinai, and the law, that is, the terms and conditions by which that covenant relationship could be maintained. These people needed to be reminded of those things. And Moses understood not only his responsibility in that regard, but he also understood the necessity of subsequent generations doing the same. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, which was such a pivotal passage for Israel's culture and religious life, so much defining who they are, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and these things you shall teach to your children also, Deuteronomy chapter 6. They shall be on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. You shall bind them as a hand. You shall speak of them when you lie down and when you rise up and when you walk by the way. Deuteronomy chapter 6 tells us that one generation has a responsibility to the next to make sure that that following generation knows from whence they have come and to what they are going. And Moses did his job well. And Moses' successor, Joshua, does the same. It is little wonder that the book of Joshua closes in chapters 23 and chapter 24 in many ways with a condensed version of the book of Deuteronomy. If you look at Joshua chapters 23 and chapter 24, you will find that they very closely mirror the words of Moses throughout the book of Deuteronomy in much abbreviated form. But Joshua, having taken up the mantle of leadership after the death of his mentor, Moses, Joshua leads the people faithfully through his lifetime. And as Joshua has led the military campaigns to take the promised land, and now his death is about to come, Joshua closes his life and his work in Joshua chapter 23, first with the leadership of Israel and then with the nation as a whole, reminding them of their history, telling them who they were and to what they have been called as the people of God, reaffirming with them the covenant that they have made and the responsibilities that come with that, and challenging them in subsequent generations to be faithful to the calling that they have received. We remember Joshua's poignant words, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." You choose for yourselves today whom you will serve. You make that choice. If you want to go back and serve the pagan gods of our forefathers whom they abandoned to serve the true and living God Jehovah, you can do that. And if you want to serve the lands of the gods of the people in whose land you now dwell, the gods who could not preserve the land for their people, the gods who had no defense against the God of heaven and the people whom God had appointed for this land, you can choose that. But on the basis of the evidence that I have seen, the basis of the evidence of our forefathers' choice, Joshua says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And he challenges the people to make that same choice. This faithful spiritual education from one generation to the next through the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Joshua is seen. And so we read in Judges chapter 2 and verse 7 that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. I have had for a while a bit of, I'll just call it, fascination with the inscriptions on headstones and cemeteries, the epitaphs. I don't spend a lot of time in cemeteries just going to read them, but if I happen to be in a cemetery, I'm going to notice what's inscribed on headstones. And particularly if it's an old cemetery, I'll look at the years of birth and death and some of the things that were written. It has caused me to wonder that if my grave is even a marked grave, and if my wife and children choose to even do anything to memorialize my earthly life, I wonder what would be written.
I wonder what would be inscribed. If there was a marked grave for Joshua, if there was something to be inscribed as a tribute to his leadership, I can think of nothing to be better said of him than Judges 2 and verse 7. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. That is, Joshua did his job well. The people were not perfect in Joshua's day, nor were they in any age. But the people, on the whole, served the Lord. And not only that, but those other leaders of the nation of Israel upon whom Joshua had influence, under their leadership, the people were faithful to the Lord. That is a powerful testament to spiritual leadership. But there is a tragic end to that story. Judges chapter 2 and picking up in verse 8 tells us that Joshua the son of Nun died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. Verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which He had done for Israel. And it is on the heels of that statement in verse 10 that we read the tragic and devastating consequences with which we began tonight in verses 11 through 15. When a generation did not know the Lord, who He was, and all that He had done for Israel to make of them the great nation that they were, and to give them the inheritance of the land that they did not earn, when a generation arose that did not know that story, apostasy was the inescapable consequence. But unfortunately, Israel is not unlike most of us today, and that we do not learn our lessons from history, for it is an error, a mistake, a tragic error, repeated later in Israel's decline, recorded for us in the book of Hosea. My people, the Lord said, are destroyed for lack of knowledge. You see, apostasy, that is departure from the Lord, a failure to serve Him and to serve Him appropriately according to the dictates of His will. That springs from the roots of a defective spiritual education when people do not know the Word of the Lord as it ought to be taught. This impresses upon us the responsibilities that we are given to bring up our children in the way that they should go, so that when they are old they will not depart from it. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. For faithful men to teach other men also, that they might be teachers also. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2. To preach the word and to be instant in season and out of season, and to reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Because, Paul warned, the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance with their own desires. You see, if we don't do our job in this generation, teaching the next, apostasy will spring among us. This is the responsibility that we have as parents and grandparents, as preachers and teachers, Bible class teachers, elders, and others who, because of age and experience, have the capacity and wisdom of leadership. Because apostasy will spring inevitably where there is a lack of knowing the Lord. In close connection, Israel's apostasy sprang from circumstances of ease. Returning to Deuteronomy chapter 6, on the heels of that pinnacle passage describing their generational responsibility one to another. The Lord warned in Deuteronomy 6, beginning in verse 10, "Then it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied. Then watch yourself, that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you, for the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth." In chapter 8, beginning in verse 11, he continues, "Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied, and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness, with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness, he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, 'My power and my strength of my hand made me this wealth.' But you shall remember the Lord your God. For it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. It shall come about that if you ever forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today that you will surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so you shall perish because you would not listen to the voice of the Lord your God." The warning could not be clearer. When you enter into that land and you receive rest from your enemies on every side, and you begin to enjoy the peace and prosperity of a land for which you have not labored, that the Lord himself has given to you despite your grumbling, complaining, and quite frankly, unworthiness, do not forget that it is the Lord who has brought you where you are. It is the Lord who has blessed you. You have not done this by your own strength or power. You are not deserving of these blessings. Do not be so content with the circumstances in which you live that you would neglect the God who has so blessed you. And yet the apostasy of which we read in the book of Judges, time and time and time again, comes on the heels of a nation having occupied the promised land and enjoyed the fruit thereof and leaving the Lord their God. Apostasy springs from circumstances of ease today, just as it did in the case of Israel. Sometimes those circumstances are not material as much as they are spiritual. In Acts chapter 20, as we referenced this morning, the Apostle Paul was meeting with the Ephesian elders in the city of Miletus. And he warned them in Acts chapter 20, beginning in verse 28, to be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock. Paul says, "I know after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And even from amongst your own selves, men will arise, speaking perverse things. Therefore, be on the alert," verse 30. The Apostle Paul says, "Do not be complacent about your spiritual circumstances, thinking that I have labored with you for a period of 3 years, and that from the city of Ephesus the word of the Lord has sounded forth throughout all of Asia, that here is a group, a relatively young group of Christians already being overseen as God would want them to be by qualified elders, and things seem to be going swimmingly." The Apostle Paul says, "Do not let down your guard. For when it is when we think we are strongest that Satan will redouble his efforts to undo us. But there is also warning of material ease. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, the Apostle Paul told Timothy to warn those who are rich, to instruct them not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but to fix their hope on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. He was to instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, and store up for themselves not treasure on earth, but rather the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Circumstances of material ease are dangerous. They are dangerous because we can be deceived in taking our hope, security, and confidence there rather in the God, than in the God who has blessed us with those material blessings. Paul says those who are rich need to be warned, they need to be instructed not to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. They need not think that that is the ultimate source of all that is good. But when we have the things that we want and even more the things that we need, we must be careful lest we forget the one who has so blessed us. Apostasy springs when we find ourselves enjoying pleasant things and we forget the one who makes life pleasant. Apostasy sprang in the history of Israel when they tolerated evil in their midst. Turning again to the book of Deuteronomy and now to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Israel received explicit instructions concerning how they were to treat those who possessed the land of Canaan before them. Deuteronomy 7, beginning in verse 1, the Lord said that when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites, the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their Asherim and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Verse 16. You shall consume all the peoples whom the Lord your God will deliver to you. Your eye shall not pity them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that would be a snare to you. Verse 25. The graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, or you will be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. You shall not bring an abomination into your house, and like it come under the ban. You shall utterly detest it, and you shall utterly abhor it, for it is something banned. The Lord could not be clearer. Do not tolerate the presence of these people in your land, but you are to entirely, totally, and without exception, drive them out and rid this land of their influence. And leave no vestige of their pagan idolatry. But every high place and every altar, every graven image, everything which is erected to the worship of any and every god that is contrary to the true God of heaven, you are to absolutely and without exception purge from your land. Do not let it be a snare. The Lord could not have been clearer. You do not tolerate that which is contrary to the nature of God himself in your midst. You are a holy people. And yet, Judges chapter 1, beginning in verse 21, tells us that the sons of Benjamin didn't drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. Verse 27 tells us that Manasseh didn't take possession of Beth Shean or its villages, or Taanach, or Dor, or Ibleam, or Megiddo, and that the Canaanites persisted in living in the land. Israel became strong and put the Canaanites to forced labor, but didn't drive them out completely. 29 tells us that Ephraim didn't drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer. And Zebulun didn't drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or Naalal. Asher didn't drive out the inhabitants of Akko or Sidon or Elab or Akzib or Helba or of Aphek or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they didn't drive them out. Verse 33 tells us that Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or of Beth Anath, but lived among the Canaanites. Verse 34 tells us that the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come to the valley. Yet the Amorites persisted in living in Mount Heriz, in Ajalon, and in Shealbim. But the power of the house of Joseph grew strong. They forced them to labor. The border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akabim, from Selah, and upward. Now notice chapter 2 beginning in verse 1. Now the angel of the Lord came from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. When Israel tolerated evil in their presence, they suffered the consequences. God could not have been clearer. Drive them out. Do not allow their influence to linger in the land that I am giving you. But when they fail to do that, the Lord would use those very people to punish His people for their disobedience, because they tolerated evil in their midst. Brethren, we are taught to have no tolerance for evil in our midst as well. When moral evil creeps in among the people of God, it must be dealt with surely and swiftly. Such is the lesson of 1 Corinthians chapter 5, as the Apostle Paul wrote to the Christians in Corinth. There was a man among the Christians there, within the body of believers in the city of Corinth, who was guilty of a kind of sexual immorality not even named among the pagans of that day. That is, he was in an illicit relationship with his father's wife, his stepmother. And the Apostle Paul says that you should not have been so arrogant concerning this to think that this was okay, but rather you should have mourned at the moral depravity which exists among you. You should have wept and dealt with these circumstances. The Apostle Paul says that he must be taught to fear. And so they are told in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 to withdraw themselves. That is, to have no association with them, no social relationship with them. That he might be shown the consequences as an extension of the fellowship that he has severed with God by his sin. But evil was not to be tolerated among the Christians. Nor was it to be tolerated in doctrinal matters. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul dealt with the issue concerning those who denied the resurrection from the dead, even in the process denying the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a consequence of their position. And it is in that context that the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Do not be deceived. The warning to not be deceived stands as a testament to the danger of deception on that point. We so often quote or cite that passage, especially when we are dealing with young people and teaching them the dangers of peer pressure, the influence of the influences of those with whom they might associate, and that warning is well and good. But in the context of 1 Corinthians 15, the corrupting danger of which the Apostle Paul was warning was doctrinal. It had moral implications, but the Apostle Paul was saying in that context, do not associate with those who would teach and practice false doctrine, because they will corrupt where you stand. Evil cannot be tolerated among the people of God. As we studied from 2 John even this morning, even at high personal cost, those things must be addressed. You see, because evil that is tolerated today will be accepted by subsequent generations. And whatever we accept here will be embraced there. And whatever we might embrace now will be openly, unashamedly, and without second thought practiced tomorrow. Apostasy springs when even the slightest vestige of evil is tolerated in our midst. The people of Israel were surrounded by the pagan and immoral lifestyles of the nations they were supposed to have driven out. And there can be little doubt, I suppose, that as they looked around them, they saw the looser moral standards of their neighbors, but also the material prosperity that they nonetheless enjoyed. One can imagine that they might begin to reason, how is it that these who live such loose and permissive lifestyles are still allowed to enjoy all of these material blessings? They are receiving the same blessings that we are promised without the same limitations, hindrances, and stringent standards. You see, apostasy springs when we are attracted by those things of the world, when we are more concerned with what is around us than what ought to be within us. We must be aware that worldly attractions are still that attractive. And we must beware lest we are, like the children of Israel of old, corrupted by their influence and tempted by them for the sake of those pursuits to depart from the living God. Paul said in 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, that those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men in ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. That is, they are guilty of apostasy because they have been attracted by the things of the world. And they are more concerned with amassing or gaining those things than they are their good standing with God. They lose sight of that which is ultimately important. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning in verse 9, the Apostle Paul pleaded with Timothy in the waning days or even hours of his life to make every effort to come to him quickly, because Demas had loved the present world and as a consequence had forsaken him. You see, the things of the world will draw us away from the things of the Lord. And so James says in James chapter 4 and in verse 4, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Dual allegiance is a foreign concept to the servant of the Most High God. Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 that our adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. That is to say that our enemy is cunning and opportunistic and well experienced in his tradecraft. He's good at what he does. And he is looking for any and every opportunity into which he can insert himself into our lives to carry us away from serving the living God. That is, to spring forth apostasy in our life. And he will use these and any other routes to his advantage. In 2001, Laura and I bought our first house in Vernon, Alabama, the town where my parents still live. We bought it from the estate of the people who had built the house in 1959-1960. And at one time, Mr. Milliken had been quite the landscaper and gardener. It had apparently been quite the property. But unfortunately, in his latter years, he was no longer able to tend to his roses or manage his garden or even keep up with the landscaping, really. And so at the west end of our house, there was a holly tree. Not a bush, but a tree. The trunk of which at its base was about that big around, and the branches of which reached to the peak of the gable end of the roof of our house on that end. This thing was wieldy and completely out of control. It's no telling how long it had been since that thing had been pruned. It was huge. Hollies are really pretty, and I really wanted to save the thing and shape it up, but it was way out of control. And furthermore, it had grown so much that the roots were growing in towards the foundation of the house, and there were even some superficial cracks beginning to appear in the brick veneer, and I just knew the thing had to go. And so one of my early man purchases was a chainsaw, on which I spent money that I really didn't have to go in there and take out a holly tree. And so I did. I cut it off just as low as I could cut it at its base and cleaned out all of the debris. As I would go about every week or so weed eating around the perimeter of my house, I'd get around to that end where that stump of that holly tree was, and there'd be little sprigs of holly shooting up around it. And I'd use my weed eater and I'd mow them down and I'd keep going, but a week or 2 weeks later, they'd be right back. And it was a process that repeated itself again and again and again. Those sprigs of holly were resilient, and they just kept coming. It was not until I hired a man to bring in a stump grinder and to grind out the stump of that holly into the ground that I quit having sprigs of holly. You see, because apostasy springs from its roots, just like that holly. If we're going to deal effectively with apostasy, we are going to have to deal with its roots. It's not enough just to merely cut off that which we can see and observe, that which grows above ground level. But if we are going to effectively deal with departures from the ways of the Lord, we're going to have to deal with the roots from which that apostasy springs. If it is a cause of defective spiritual education, then get it right and teach the Lord and His book. If we've become complacent in our circumstances, then grow out of it and realize that there is work to be done. If we are tolerating evil, then that must stop. And if we have become infatuated by the things of the world, then we need to reacquaint ourselves with the God with whom we must be infatuated if we are going to please Him. You see, dealing with apostasy is only successfully done when we deal with the roots of it. And that is exactly what Paul said to those elders in Acts chapter 20 and verse 32. And now I commend you to God and to the word of His grace, which is able to build you up and to give you the inheritance among all those who are sanctified. Deal with the roots. And when we do, that is not to say that Satan will cease his battle, but we will effectively combat the influence of apostasy in our individual lives, in the lives of our families, in the lives of the local churches of which we are a part. Thank you for your kind and patient attention this evening. May I encourage you to get a songbook and open to number 326. The plea of this song is simple and direct. Trust and obey. Trust the Lord whose faithfulness has been demonstrated on every page of Bible history. Trust Him who has so orchestrated and written the scheme of redemption from eternity past to this moment in time to give you this opportunity to respond to the invitation of Jesus Christ. Trust Him who above all is trustworthy, and obey Him. Let not your love for Him be merely in word or in sentiment of heart, but in the action that you take. Come repenting of your sins. That is turning from those things that are contrary to His will. Confessing faith in Jesus as the Son of God who loved you and died for you, and be baptized in water for the remission of your sins. Jesus said, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." And that is our plea with you tonight. If you have obeyed the gospel, you have trusted Him and obeyed, but you have not been faithful to your calling. It has not remained the pole star, the pinnacle, the absolute focus of your life. And there is some way that we as your brothers and sisters in Christ can help you. Whatever your need, won't you simply trust and obey? Come to the front and respond to the invitation of Jesus as we stand and sing for your encouragement.